Welcome to Reconceive, a Beyond Studio podcast, where two mental health therapists and a fitness coach explore the interweaving connections of mind, body, and spirit. Every episode covers an area of this connection and how we can reimagine ourselves and our world when we see these connections more clearly.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Reconceive, a Beyond Studio podcast. This is episode 3, and today we're continuing our conversation about how relationships heal us, or sometimes don't. So let's get started.
Okay, so we are going to recap our last conversation about how relationships heal us or don't. And I just want to remind listeners about relational cultural theory and some of the things we started talking about last time. And then we'll kind of segue into today's topic, which has to do with codependency. So back to relational cultural theory, we were talking about mutuality last time and really talking about what it means to be in a mutual relationship, one where both parties are, you know, sharing feelings at pretty much the same level, and both partners feel like they can be vulnerable and it's safe to do that, and both are invested in growth, and power is shared pretty evenly. So we talked about how that feels, and then we also talked about what it feels like when that's not the case in a relationship, where there's a lack of mutuality and things aren't balanced and power is not even. And I know we've all had relationships like that where we felt one down, or maybe we were in a relationship where we felt like we had too much power and we started to lose respect for the person we were dating or our friend or whatever because they seemed so weak in the relationship. It can go either way. So there's another piece of this that we started to kind of talk about last time and we didn't really flesh it out. But I want to mention some research that's been compiled by a physician, and his name is Gaber Mate. And Melissa and I got to hear him speak at the Emdria conference last fall, and he was wonderful. He talked about trauma, and he also talked about his book, which is entitled When the Body Says No. So I'll just plug his book because it is a very important read. I think everybody should read it. It's about the kinds of illnesses that we now know are connected to our continual suppression and repression of our feelings in a relationship or in more than one relationship. So if you haven't read the book, Gaber Mate talks about his own patients. He's been in palliative care. He's been in addictions treatment. He's done a number of different kinds of medicine. And he reviews his work with even some famous people who sought out his services, including when they were dying. So some of the diseases that would be on the list of things that he talked about would be anything that has an autoimmune component, including Parkinson's, MS, Crohn's disease, rheumatoid arthritis. All the cancers would be on his list, and he most specifically targets breast cancer.
Because of the hormonal component.
Because of the hormonal component.
Anything that is an endocrine disorder, there's a lot of disruption that happens in the endocrine system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, disruption because of emotion that is held back, that's not spoken. So the people whose obituaries he read to us, it was really, really interesting. They tended to be pillars of the community. They tended to work very hard. They always were available to help. They always were at work. They never missed work. You know, they were just those those people, those so nice, so good all the time kinds of people. And then they tended to, you know, have these very debilitating diseases that were an example of the body attacking itself, the self attacking the self. So that's connected to a number of things that we need to talk about, and we're going to get into part of that today. Diseases where the body is attacking itself, and where people are holding back emotions, suppressing how they really feel in favor of protecting some version of the relationship. Have you ever done that? My guess is you probably have experienced it. I know I have. And what does that mean? So let's just kind of open it up right there.
I think there are so many examples of when you listen to somebody's story, there is a connection between when their body started shutting down, mm-hmm. when they started beginning to have symptoms, and a recent stressor. And I think culturally we're kind of coming around to the idea that stress is a health issue, right? You know, mm-hmm. our doctors are talking to us about it. We're encouraged to do things like exercise to relieve stress, etc. You know, yoga, meditation, all of that. But I think it goes even one step further than that. If we can begin to kind of open up to the idea that stress is not just a thing to be relieved or experienced, it's never benign. It's going to go somewhere. It's going to do something. It's a kind of energy that happens in our body, and it will either get used or it will find a way to turn against us. Mm-hmm. And so I've talked to, you know, so many clients and so many just people in my own life where they start experiencing those symptoms because they have not been able to resolve the emotional component of whatever happened to them. I was just talking to somebody recently and just offhanded made a comment about how much stress they had in their life over the last decade, and it's amazing that their body hasn't turned against them. And he looked at me and he said, well, I did have cancer a couple years ago. Mm. And my first thought was, of course, this makes so much sense. And so I think, you know, if we're paying attention, we see this pattern over and over where as our body is beginning to, you know, signal to us that something is wrong, there is this huge emotional component. We have to figure out what to do with that.
Mm-hmm. Right. I know for myself that I was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2011, and I had just gone through a really hideous time of being bullied in the workplace in an academic environment, and that was so stressful. I remember thinking, when it was all sort of piling up on me, that I had some empathy for my body and wondered what the impact was. And then coming out of that, getting out of that workplace, and kind of breathing a sigh of relief, and then finding out, yes, there is this cancer. Mm-hmm. So I've experienced it personally.
I see it a lot from clients who aren't making the connection of the emotional holding and the illness. A lot of times they'll come into fitness knowing that their physician recommended that they relieve their diabetes or help with their obesity or relieve their fibromyalgia, migraine symptoms with exercise, not realizing that it's not just a purely medical issue, it's an emotional medical issue of whatever they're mm-hmm. repressing. And so as they start to work through exercise, we all know that exercise a lot of times releases emotions, and you're able then to, as the trainer, make the connections. They're starting to talk to you, open up, and then hopefully lead them to not just exercise, but a therapist, a professional like you, then to help them deal with the emotional side, to help them heal as well.
And it's curious to me, I see people have such a resistance sometimes to that connection. Mm-hmm. There's something in us that doesn't want to believe that. We either think, oh, that must be too simple, or that must be way too complicated. I'm not always sure which one it is. But I think all of us have this sense of that there has to be a different answer, or we want a different answer. I know I remember, Deborah, you and I having a conversation years ago at this point. The way my body decided to rebel against me was with struggles with fertility. And I remember you saying something to me about that emotional connection. And my first instinct was to want to say, no, that clearly cannot be it. That can't be it. Because I think it is scary and a little overwhelming to think that this very real and tangible difficulty that we're dealing with, pain or, you know, not being able to overcome a symptom that we're dealing with, that it could have deep, dark roots in a place that I really don't want to go. And we want to say no to that. We don't want to go there. And I think we do naturally have a lot of resistance to that. I will say the end of that story real shortly is that I did get EMDR with Deborah on that issue, and I'm expecting my first baby here shortly. Because of those experiences, once you've been through that cycle a few times, you begin to accept it because the evidence is so clear, and the change that occurs is so clear when you start clearing out the emotional issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is very true. And so our topic for today relates directly to the repression of emotion. What is codependency? And I'm asking for all definitions because I will say that I have been a non-believer in codependency for most of my life. And it's only been recently that I've accepted that it's a thing. And I have my suspicions about what it is. What do you guys think it is?
Before we do that, Deborah, I'm curious, why do you think you didn't want to accept it?
Well, it was so pop psychology.
Okay.
I mean, this was in the 90s, and I was being trained, and I said, that's not a real diagnosis. That's not real. You know, where is this coming from? This is just people trying to make more labels for us, more things to hang on us and make us feel sick. So I don't know. And something, you know, the literature seemed cheesy to me at the time. Mm-hmm. I probably would enjoy it now. I probably would get a lot out of it. But that's how I felt. And so I still don't really know what it is.
I think there are a whole bunch of different definitions. You know, the kind of the Bible of codependency is written by a lady named Melody Beatty. And it's called Codependent No More.
I made fun of her in the
Okay. Thank you for that confession.
I'm sorry, Melody.
Yeah. Her book was originally written from the perspective of a family member of an alcoholic. That's how most people are introduced to the idea of codependency, is a family member, specifically the spouse or the child, of an alcoholic, of an addict, etc. Since then, it has kind of exploded in broadness to really include all kinds of emotional dysregulation. I think my favorite definition, which is not official at all, but it's the one that made me a believer and really connected with me, was that a codependent is anybody that has learned to control our own discomfort by controlling other people. And that, when I heard that, at first, everything in me said, well, clearly that's not me. I'm not a controlling person at all because I'm too nice to be controlling, right? By the way, all good codependents are really, really nice people on the surface. Let's just be clear about that.
Oh, nice people like nice all the people with Lou Gehrig's disease,
yes,
right?
Exactly. It's a nice people syndrome, truly.
Oh my
goodness. The pattern of codependency that I see, certainly is odd in my own life, because I will raise my hand to this label happily because it really opened up a whole lot of growth for me once I got a hold of it. The pattern for most of us is we are trained at some really early time in our life that we cannot be okay if the people around us are not okay. And as a kid, that's really true a lot of the time. We are so powerless in our own situation. We have very limited ability to affect our own situation that we learn to keep mom or dad happy, that we learn to keep teachers happy, etc. We learn to be really likable, charismatic, whatever we need to do. We become the entertainer. We become the peacemaker in order to manage our own anxiety. It all comes from this place of, I am not okay. I am not okay. And the only way that I know how to change that is by making you okay. And we will develop all kinds of different ways to do that. And there are different versions of this. And so we see codependency look like all kinds of different things. It really varies between men and women. I think we've a lot of times assumed that this was a very feminine thing. It is really not. There's a lot of male codependency. It just looks really different.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be the doers in the I'm going to provide sense, or in the financial sense. The women, we're still doers about it, but it's much more in the emotional sense and the giving, the typical I'm the mom that does for everybody all the time.
So, Melissa, that makes me think of the word martyr. The mother that's the martyr.
Absolutely.
And that sounds like such a negative word, and I don't mean it like that. They're usually very nice, and it comes from a very good place.
Mm-hmm.
But look what I do for everyone around me. I have to keep everybody happy. I have to be the fixer, the doer.
Exactly. And the cycle of codependency is we start out by being that giving, overly nurturing, overly peacemaker person that does for everybody else. Eventually, as we stay in that, though, the end result is resentment. There is no way to stay in that pattern of always doing for everybody else, because if that's what we're doing, we end up with nothing for ourselves. We end up looking around at our life going, I just spent all these years, because for most of us, it's years, doing for somebody else, taking care of somebody else, and now I'm, you know, here at the end of my life or here at this point in my life looking around going, well, what's in it for me? Why am I doing this? And we get resentful towards those people. We get angry. And that is often, you see older codependents that have been at it for decades and decades that are very cynical, bitter, resentful people. They may stay in the same behavior patterns, but it's not from this place of joy. There's no pleasure in the giving. If there ever was, they get angry.
And then they get ill.
Yes. I think that's exactly what happens. And I think it's at that point where we see the body start to break down.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. And can you be in a relationship where both people are codependent?
Absolutely.
Oh, completely.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I've started to think is maybe the difference between dependency and codependency. Because if I'm a child, I'm truly dependent on my parent, right? That's a true dependence. But if I'm codependent, that implies there are two of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think the issue is that for the person that is codependent, it really truly feels like you are dependent on that person. It feels impossible that I could actually be okay if you're not okay. You know, this is the person who, if their spouse has a bad day at work and they come in and they immediately feel that vibe of, oh no, something's wrong, they will spend the rest of their evening trying to fix their partner's mood. Hmm. And I remember someone telling me for the first time that maybe that wasn't my job. Maybe I had no responsibility for that.
Right.
And that it was really okay for me to go on and have a perfectly good evening, even if he could not. And that was mind-blowing to me. I had truly never even considered that this was an option because it felt so much like a responsibility, an obligation, and there was honestly a fear of if I let that not okayness stay there too long, what's it going to do to my world? And I did not believe that it was possible for me to have any okayness if my closest people were not okay. And so I think recovery from codependency, like actual change, is when we begin to detach from that idea and really can stand back and say, if you're not okay, I can still care about that, but I don't have to do anything about that. There's literally no responsibility that's put on me for whatever is happening to that person. Another note of that is that this is why so many codependents end up in helping professions.
As we all sit around here.
It's true, though. It's true. If you're in a group of, therapists or doctors or, doctors, some yes, some no, but certainly in any health profession, I would assume that health coaches, yoga teachers, all of those people end up in the same kind of thing. Most of us got into this because we feel so at home in taking care of other people's needs.
And intuiting their feelings, reading them.
Yeah. Reading them,
yep.
Helping them have a better day, releasing that stress.
And it feels good to us. It feels so good to us.
Rewarding. I'm changing someone's life and someone's world.
It is. The thing I heard just recently about codependence, and I got this from, what is her name? Okay, never mind. I'll come back to that. That codependency develops when children do not feel psychologically seen by their family, their parents. Mm-hmm. They don't feel seen or known. So,
which is why there are a lot of codependents of alcoholic parents. Mm-hmm. Because their parents can't see them and can't hear them.
Okay.
If they're drunk.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's whose needs are most important in the home. If if a child grows up in a home where somebody else's needs are always more important than theirs, then the message that we get is your needs don't matter. And the feeling is invisibility and unworthiness. And so the only way, if you feel invisible and unworthy, and the only way that you were ever able to do anything about that was to take care of somebody else, we just carry that pattern right on with us into adulthood. We get what we need by caring for other people.
And they're observing the codependent behavior of the parent that's mm-hmm. not the alcoholic.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. That's really true.
Lisa Romano mm-hmm. is who I was thinking of. She has a YouTube series, and she talks about this in depth. And so she says that we carry forward that need of, I don't know who I am. I don't feel seen. We carry that forward into our adult relationships, and then we're seeking validation. I know that's been true for me. Mm-hmm. So I'll tell on myself again, because I think this really applies. I've mentioned growing up in a very rigidly religious environment, my family and my community. And what I think happened that, you know, nobody drank. So it's not like I had drunk parents, but I had parents who were really distracted. They were really distracted. They really could not read emotion because they were too busy trying to be good and trying to make sure there were no visible sins on the outside of our family that anybody could point fingers to. So they really didn't see us, see me, psychologically. And I think I definitely carried that forward into my adult relationships. I think I've been seeking to be validated, to be seen, to be understood. Like, that's been a real craving mm-hmm. of mine. And I would almost sacrifice myself and my growth in order to have that.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like your identity was only allowed to develop according to other people. Like, you
yes.
didn't get to decide who you were, how you felt about things, what you really wanted, thought, etc. It was always about how your behavior impacted somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
How it makes us look, mm-hmm. or how it pleases God. I mean, are you gonna go to hell if we die in a car accident today?
Mm-hmm.
So it's really not about what you're thinking or feeling mm-hmm. or needing.
Mm-hmm. It's about what you're earning or not earning.
Mm-hmm.
And how that judgment would go for you if it was passed today.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
So my personal experience is to be a outside observer from a very large family of adult children with an alcoholic father and a very codependent mother, and watch how all of those adult children develop later in life and parent their own families. And that each one struggles with a different issue. Either they become a codependent, even if they don't in turn marry an alcoholic. Some of them do wind up marrying an alcoholic, but they have that anger, which leads to other illnesses. Or maybe they develop diabetes, or maybe they develop obesity, an eating disorder, or another sort of addiction. And then watching that next generation either repeat the pattern again or go to a completely opposite reaction, where it's completely detached, leave the situation, and try to keep themselves out of the situation as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But really watching that effect on all of these individuals' health and well-being.
Yeah.
Well, and I wonder if, you know, part of what we're saying is that the reason why health is so connected to this issue is because no matter what version it currently takes, whether it's active addiction, emotional repression, full-on codependency, whatever, there is still a lack of emotional stability, attunement, acceptance with yourself and then in your relationships. And that is what makes us sick. That inability for our emotions to do what they're meant to do and go where they're meant to go is what keeps us, makes us, and then keeps us sick.
Like anger.
Yeah.
I studied anger back in the 90s again when I was not believing in codependency. I was studying women's anger, and my colleagues and I found, you know, tons of research on anger suppression and depression, particularly in women. But we found one lonely study linking suppressed anger, in particular, with breast cancer, of all things. Mm. One lonely study. Now there are more, and that goes into the big mountain of things that I was talking about earlier. We have lots more evidence. But I hung on to that idea because breast cancer was in my family, and I thought about, like, my grandmother suppressing her emotion, particularly anger. And she was married to really quite a jerk. I mean, may he rest in peace. He wasn't a good spouse. She was angry all the time. But there was no outlet for that because in the religious milieu that they were in, you know, you just weren't angry. You just couldn't be.
Particularly as a woman.
Particularly mm-hmm. as a woman, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I can't help thinking that this is pretty big with our clients who have fibromyalgia mm-hmm. and RA and some of those things that really it's they're pissed off mm-hmm. and there's no channel.
There's no way to outlet that anger.
Yeah.
And even I think, you know, anger is a huge one. Fear is another huge one, or that sense of loss of control, being out mm-hmm. of control in our own life. I think that is another really damaging one that I see that has a lot of health connection. You know, when I'm talking to a client, if they tell me that they are dealing with an endocrine health issue, polycystic ovarian syndrome, infertility, all of that, I have made a habit of asking about sexual assault mm-hmm. or sexual abuse in their history because that correlation is so incredibly strong. And while, yes, I think anger is a piece of it, the other thing is that sense of loss of control over myself, that I no longer feel or have that sense of I can control my body, my space, my environment. And when we lose that, I think that that really begins to deteriorate our health. And these are things that if we look at how our culture handles them, they're often things that there is kind of a deadline for how long you're allowed to be upset about it. And we get a lot of input about the appropriate level of reaction to these things. So one really good example, I have a lot of women that deal with birth trauma. And one of the things that I always hear is when I try to talk to somebody about what happened to me during my birth, they immediately say, well, at least you have a healthy baby. As if the fact that my baby didn't die means that there is only an allowed amount of distress that I can have about what I went through. And so I think that message of here's the amount of emotional response that you're allowed. And if it goes beyond that, mm-hmm. then you have to suppress mm-hmm. and repress. And that I think that goes for loss of control, anger, all of that.
I think our society is so uncomfortable with those emotional responses. Have it and be over with it and let's move mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm. Because that happens, that type of example with the birthing experience happens a lot of times with people's reaction to cancer. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, you're angry about it now. Let's move forward and start the healing mm-hmm. process. Mm-hmm. Well, you have cancer. Shouldn't you be allowed to be as angry as long as you want?
Right. Or still have feelings about it even if you're in remission?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Even if, you know, you get a happy ending to the story, I think our attitude is that somehow that's supposed to negate or wipe away all of the emotion that we had in the midst of that experience.
Yeah.
And that really limits the permission that we feel to express and continue to express, to continue to react, to continue to be triggered if we need to have a hard time with things that remind us of that experience. There seems to be kind of an end date and a deadline of when we're supposed to be done with all of that.
And going back to the loss of power and control, I think going back to Deborah, too, talking about two codependents in a relationship, mm-hmm. I think there's this constant fear and back and forth of loss of power and control, mm-hmm. and each person trying to keep control, mm-hmm. but not being able to totally keep control with the other person also being a codependent.
Right.
And this anger back and forth that maybe doesn't always get discussed and brought to the surface because everyone's walking on eggshells and trying mm-hmm. to keep each other happy. This constant power struggle mm-hmm. in the relationship.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's plop this right in the middle of relationship and what happens there. Yeah, so say more about, I'm curious about this control part, the struggle for control.
Well, I think as codependents, they'll want to maintain the control that Melissa was talking about, making sure everything was happy at the home, that everybody was happy.
Okay.
So there's this level of keeping everything well around you.
So that I don't have to be afraid, so that I don't have to think.
And trying to suppress that fear.
Okay.
But then also almost both being the martyr and trying to have it done your way.
Having a contest to see who's the most martyrly.
Oh my goodness,
I want you to do this my way, and that other person wants it done their way, and they both see it's the best way, and it's not going to work unless, you know, the peace won't be established unless it's done each other's way, rather than coming together and sharing the power and working through it as a team.
Right. There's that version. There's also the version of playing chicken with our opinions, as in who's going to give in first and actually have an opinion about this. Because if you have two people that are so conciliatory, and it's...
I don't care either.
Whatever you want. Right? How many conversations have we had like this? And we can drive each other nuts. But honestly, that is a codependent conversation. Even, you know, even not being able to declare, this sounds good for lunch. Does that sound good to you? There's people that even the idea of declaring something that firm feels like overstepping something that they're comfortable with. I remember somebody, I think I was in an Al-Anon meeting when someone was talking about how for codependents, we use each other like a drug. And I remember just feeling punched in the gut when they said, because it feels so bad to realize that to that other person, that's exactly what it feels like. They feel used like an object rather than me having an authentic relationship with them. Because what does it feel like to the other person when we refuse to actually show up in a relationship, refuse to have an opinion, refuse to say how we really feel about anything?
It's exhausting.
It's exhausting.
Mm-hmm. Lonely.
We've all had friends.
Yep.
Like that. And it's just, you just want to shake them and say, make your own decision.
Yeah.
I want you to take control.
Or are you in there?
Yes.
are you in there somewhere?
I want to know who you really are for once.
Yes.
I don't want to be the person that is leading this relationship.
Yeah. I do. I think they end up feeling used and manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they get angry at us and we get into this really bad pattern of resentment and anger and we're using each other. And if you have two codependents and that's going round and round, that can get really, really messy. And almost always those relationships do not, they can't last. They just can't.
So we were just musing a little while ago about what happens when one partner in a relationship tries to get healthy. Like one partner goes to therapy and the other partner is not ready. I hear this all the time, by the way. And it's not always the woman who comes in first. Sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Sometimes men come in first. So trying to get healthy, trying to do things that are good for my body, and I'm meditating, I'm exercising, I'm making new friends. And my partner is sitting at home, not doing any of those things. And I'm feeling different and more different and more different. And I'm feeling happy on the one hand until I go home and I see what's still going on there. But I don't want to upset my partner. I don't want to say too much. So what's that? Who's being codependent there?
Mm-hmm.
Is that codependent?
Maybe both.
Maybe both.
I think like part of the question is it okay for us to really be detached in some way? What was the other word you used? I say detached, you say differentiated.
Differentiated.
Right.
Yes.
But there's something to that where we no longer feel the need to ride the emotional roller coaster of another person.
Oh, right.
Whatever that is. That doesn't mean that I don't have a relationship with them. I remember reading in a book, I don't know if it was Melody Beattie's book or a different one, but they had a little picture of stick figures. And here's a codependent relationship where if you draw two stick figures on top of each other, you literally cannot tell whose head belongs to it, right? It's just, it looks like one stick figure. And for a codependent, you know, 100% codependent looks like that. We're two stick figures on top of each other. I can't tell the difference. But as we try to separate out from that, I think there's kind of a spectrum where we're somewhat differentiated. We're trying to detach, but we're still having some trouble figuring out, does this belong to me? Does this belong to you?
Mm-hmm.
Am I supposed to keep this and care about this, or am I not?
Yeah.
Because honestly, I don't feel like there is a great template for what this is supposed mm-hmm. to look like. So many of us really struggle to find an example
yeah.
of a relationship that does this really well, consistently, across the span of all the different changes that a relationship goes through, that I think, Deborah, your confusion feels super familiar. And also something that a lot of people, they're going to spend some phase when they're trying to make changes, because it's just impossible to not question ourselves and wonder, am I being a jerk? Am I being mean?
Yeah.
Am I
selfish and arrogant like my mom said I was?
Right.
So, yeah. So, yes, differentiation. I like that word. That comes from family psychology. And by the way, why cannot psychology and AA get married? Why won't they?
I think that we could, except we have to quit fighting first.
Well, see, that would solve the whole issue
really would.
Because I think that AA and Al-Anon, they're trying to work out their terms. They're trying to sort of, they have a whole vocabulary that psychology hasn't accepted.
Right.
And vice versa. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So from family psychology, we get this word differentiation. And it means becoming a self, becoming a whole autonomous, interdependent self. So I can be deeply connected with another person while retaining my selfhood. Mm-hmm. And that kind of sounds like what you're talking about, Melissa, kind of like we're still in a relationship. I still love you, mm-hmm. and I'm not going on the roller coaster ride anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm done with the roller coaster. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But then a lot of times that codependent will sense that differentiation and come grasping mm-hmm. back at you to try to hold on to that relationship.
Yes, it's true. And that happens in families when someone starts to get healthy and they differentiate from the family. There is a huge gravitational pull. People want you to change back and become the little Shauna that they miss so much. Mm-hmm. They want you to turn back into that person that they could know in a particular way.
I see it a lot with clients mm-hmm. as they start to exercise and eat healthy.
Yeah.
And if someone at home isn't supporting that or they're not losing the weight and getting healthy, then they try to sabotage all that progress.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of behavior is exactly the opposite of differentiated.
Correct.
Not being allowed to let the other person either be where they are in their lack of progress or move ahead of us. Mm-hmm. Anytime that we feel the need to pull or push another person, I think is a sign to us that we're off somewhere. And so I know for a lot of people, I hear this, I'm making so much progress and I just want my partner to come with me. And part of that, of course we do. Wouldn't it be wonderful if they could? On the other hand, why are we waiting? On the other hand, why do we feel that compulsion to make sure that they are joining us in that? I think a part of it is because we care about them, but then there's another really big part that we don't feel okay about moving past somebody.
Afraid.
Yeah.
Fear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Scared to death. What is that going to mean? Mm-hmm. If I get healthy, if I really start to bloom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Will I have to leave you in the dust?
Yeah. I had a really close friend that struggled with this with a job promotion. And as we were talking about it, he was able to figure out that he had gotten promotions before this. No problem. And then suddenly he had all of this guilt, this self-doubt. I'm not sure this is the right thing. And he figured out it was the moment that he started making more money than his dad did.
Oh,
And on some level, this makes so much sense. Mm-hmm. When we start to surpass the people around us, it's that push-pull of, is this really okay?
Mm-hmm.
Is it really okay for me to move beyond this point and leave people behind?
Is it okay for me to have true love when my mother never had true
mm-hmm.
love?
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
Right. Am I setting my expectations too high? Do I have too big of an opinion of myself to think that I deserve this when so many people don't get it? Right? I think a lot of us get that message.
Yeah.
Or to when are you ever satisfied?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When's enough for you?
Yeah. When is it going to be enough?
Yeah.
So could it be that differentiation is the opposite of codependency?
I think so.
I agree.
Yeah. I tend to use that word detachment, and I think people hear that as kind of a negative thing, but to me, detachment and being differentiated means freedom. Not only freedom to do what I want to do, it's not actually, that's never the focus of it, but it's a feeling of freedom to have a real relationship, freedom to have a relationship without any gains, which is so wonderful.
When those people can do that, there's all this growth that automatically happens, this coming together without actually being one, and you can feed off each other and support each other without being continuously dependent and attached to each other.
Right.
It'll happen more naturally.
Right.
So we can have arguments, because we'll need to have arguments, and I can speak my mind because I'm not afraid of what's going to happen if I do that, and you can do the same. So then we grow
and respect each other's opinion and maybe learn from it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so we get back to that idea of mutuality, that we are able to be in a mutual, even relationship with another person. And if we recognize that we're not, we have the freedom to do something about it or to accept that we're currently not without feeling any sense of obligation in order to fix it, like it's somehow our job. I think it goes back to that sense of we're all striving for mutual relationships to be on the same footing, have the same amount of power.
I love that.
Well, thank you guys so much for joining us for this episode. This is, once again, our third episode at Reconceive, and we will be back in a couple of weeks.
Thank you so much for listening to Reconceive. Don't forget to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes so that you don't miss an episode. Follow us at Reconceive Podcast on Facebook or Instagram, and find us on our website at beyondstudio417.com/reconceive. And if anything you've heard today has made you wonder if it's time to reach out for help, please don't ignore that. Message us for assistance in finding a qualified therapist in your area. We would enjoy helping you in that way. From all of us here at Reconceive, see you next time.